Deutsche Welle Africa Link.
Great to have your company on this edition of Africa Link from our studios in Bonn. I'm Crispin Mwakideu. Coming up, South African Finance Minister Pravin Gordhan delivers an upbeat budget as the country heads to the polls.
We have weathered the storm. We have laid the foundation for a faster and more inclusive path of growth in the years ahead. This is a good story to tell.
A human rights group which lobbied for the acquittal of a Zambian human rights activist speaks of their daily challenges.
I think for gay rights activists, before they can even speak about gay rights, they need to be acknowledged that they even have the right to speak.
And Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta has been in Juba after warning South Sudan's conflict is worsening. These stories and more coming up in the next 25 minutes. I'll be right back.
Top story.
Billions ahead of the ballot. The South African government has announced a 1 trillion rand budget before the crucial May 7 general elections. Minister of Finance Pravin Gordhan allocated billions of rand to employment creation initiatives, social grants, housing, education, health and agriculture. However, as Tuzo Kumalo reports from Johannesburg, some say the budget is full of empty promises and is only meant to garner support for the ruling African National Congress ahead of the poll.
Presenting his budget speech at the South African Parliament in Cape Town on Wednesday, Finance Minister Pravin Gordhan allocated 9.3 billion rand in income tax relief to households. He added that in the next 3 years, the government will build over 200,000 houses for the poor, connect 900,000 households to electricity, provide over 11 million children with child support grants, and rebuild over 400 schools. He also promised 6 million jobs in the next 5 years, with 847 billion rand being set aside for developing public infrastructure.
We have weathered the storm. Employment and incomes have recovered. The value of the social wage has increased. We have laid the foundation for a faster and more inclusive path of growth in the years ahead. This is a good story to tell.
Among those who agree with that assessment is Johannesburg resident Bridget Dube.
I think it's good because to those people who are poor and those who can't afford to get jobs, there is more chances to get just because of the budget that has been increased. The students who can't pay their school fees, now they can have bursary that will be provided by the government.
Civil servant Nondumiso Dlomo also has praise, but some questions as well.
Yes, I'm happy with that, but the thing, if they do that budget increase, they're going to be price increase like petrol, food, school fees. So it can help, but otherwise there's no use for it.
For Nondobeko Makubane, who is unemployed, the budget is just an election gimmick.
It's too good to be true. I think it's meant to attract voters. Why do they not do these good things over these years? It's about 4 years promising these things. It's never been fulfilled.
Opposition parties also weighed in on the budget speech. While some welcomed the focus on improving basic services for the poor majority, others like Inkatha Freedom Party leader Mangosuthu Buthelezi doubted the promises made.
There was no earth-shaking story, which I expected, because we've made so many promises in the past, and the head of state himself and head of government has made many promises in the past which have not been fulfilled.
With national elections to elect a new government expected in May, the ruling African National Congress will now have to work hard to convince the electorate that promises made in the budget will be fulfilled. And the opposition will be doing its best to prove the opposite.
Tuzo Kumalo in Johannesburg. 2013 was a challenging fiscal year for Africa's biggest economy. South Africa experienced slow economic growth, increasing rates of unemployment, and government spending exceeded revenue. South African motorists also had to cope with the implementation of e-tolls, the weakening of the rand, and a dip in investor confidence. I've been speaking to Daniel Silke, an independent political analyst in Cape Town, to find out whether the elections influenced this year's budget.
Well, I don't think it specifically influenced it. I think normally what would happen is that in advance of an election, any finance minister would clearly want to show the country what he had achieved and what his administration had achieved. And the minister, we spent a lot of time talking about how South Africa is indeed better off today than it was in the past. And he spoke about the many advantages and state expenditures that there have been on the poor for social services over the last few years. So I think he made the point that there has been provision from government and that the population therefore should recognize that government has delivered to them. But of course, he also made a big point about the future, about the government's commitment to a new national development plan program, which would be implemented towards 2030 and after the next election. So I think that from the government's point of view, this was a fairly good news budget given the trying and difficult circumstances. And its aim really was to tell South Africans things are not that bad and government has indeed achieved over the last few years.
Talking of good news, Minister Gordhan hinted at giving tax relief for low-income earners. Is that going to bring true relief or is it just meant to attract votes?
South Africans have been paying creeping indirect taxes on a number of different forms of their budget over the course of the last number of years. South Africans are suffering under record high petrol prices and fuel prices. Now they're going to pay even more on this. So there are also sort of indirect taxes that affect the middle classes, those relatively low earning taxpayers. So the relief that I think comes is really a relief from the pressures of inflation rather than putting any substantial amount of money back in the consumer's pockets. And the consumer is under great stress in South Africa at the moment. High levels of debt in the country. Retail sales are looking rather lackluster for the year. I don't think this is really going to help that.
The finance minister also came out strongly saying corruption has to be stopped. But isn't that ironic, bearing in mind President Jacob Zuma himself is embroiled in a corruption scandal over alleged use of taxpayers' money to upgrade Nkandla private residence?
There's no doubt that government has a major credibility problem when it talks about corruption, given the issues still surrounding President Zuma. But at the same time, the finance minister explained how there had been a substantial progress in the fight against crime and how money had been saved in the process. So there's, in a sense, a sort of a contradictory approach in government. Middle-ranking bureaucrats who are indeed found out on corrupt practices now do find themselves in difficulties, and there's, I think, all sorts of new measures to try and protect government departments from irregular, in particular, tender fraud that is often the cause of all of this corruption. But some of the senior cabinet ministers and from the president down who are still embroiled in these various issues, they have yet really to be held accountable.
The ANC has also allocated around 410 billion rand to social grants over the next 3 years. But is that money enough, and what will it be spent on?
Well, we've seen a massive rollout in social grants over the last decade or so, one of the fastest anywhere in the world. 16.5 million South Africans are now reliant upon these payments every single month. And we will see a continuation of that going forward. We've got a young population, a growing population. The big problem for South Africa is that we have to grow our economy and up our GDP rate beyond the rather lackluster 2% or so that we've had last year in order to continue to finance these social income grants. There's the possibility that if we do not grow our economy sufficiently in the next few years, we could very well find ourselves in a position not that dissimilar to Greece when they couldn't pay their debts. The income grants have been a very successful tool to bridge inequality in South Africa, but at the same time, the income grants also make those who receive those grants a little more loyal to the ruling political party and a little more afraid of perhaps voting against the ruling party.
Are you convinced by the government's promise to control expenditure over the next 3 years?
I think that there's a lot more to be done, and he has to crack the whip to a much greater degree. But this budget was really very much a holding pattern, really just tread water until the new administration kicks in, even though it's going to probably be the same political party that wins office again.
Independent political analyst Daniel Silke in Cape Town.
Africa Link, every weekday on Deutsche Welle.
Killing of the helpless. Sick patients in South Sudan have been shot to death in their beds and medical facilities looted and burned to the ground, according to aid organization Doctors Without Borders. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta has been in Juba for talks after his top security organ warned of the deteriorating situation and a total disregard of a ceasefire deal in South Sudan. James Shimanyula reports.
Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta visited South Sudan on Wednesday in his capacity as chairman of the East African Community. Shortly after holding private talks with the country's President Salva Kiir, Kenyatta addressed a press conference in the capital, Juba. Kenyatta stressed the importance of the restoration of peace in Africa's newest nation, which has been torn apart by ethnic violence.
The entire region, we stand in solidarity with the people of South Sudan, and we urge all leaders to ensure that what needs to be done is done for the sake of peace and stability. We want to see cessation of hostilities. We want to have the ability in the shortest possible time to also put in place the monitoring mechanism.
Kenyatta's visit came shortly after Kenya's National Security Council approved the deployment of 310 soldiers to South Sudan in line with last year's United Nations Security Council approval, bringing to 1,000 the number of Kenyan troops in the troubled nation. The visit also coincided with the disclosure by the country's religious leaders that ethnic killings are still taking place in several places in the country as Father Santino Orino of the Catholic Church in Wau Town, Western Bahar El Ghazal State explains.
People are dying. People are killing themselves. Brothers and sisters of God are killing themselves. How can we interpret this? We need to pray. We need to cry louder. And we need to have that faith in us which will discover the love of God for us.
The gravity of the killings has been vividly underlined by Joseph Contreras, United Nations acting spokesman in South Sudan. Releasing a special UN report on 6 weeks of fighting at a press conference in Juba, Contreras accused both sides of committing atrocities.
Numerous witnesses told our investigators of the deliberate targeting of both national and foreign civilians in extrajudicial and other unlawful killings, including mass killings, enforced disappearances, gender-based violence such as rapes and gang rapes, and instances of ill treatment and torture by forces from both sides of the conflict.
More than 10,000 people are believed to have been killed in South Sudan since an attempted coup on President Salva Kiir in December last year.
James Shimanyula in Nairobi.
Behind the headlines.
How common is the Commonwealth? That's not a question to put to Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe or Gambia's Yahya Jammeh. The two African nations pulled out from the organization, citing neocolonialism. The Commonwealth, headed by Queen Elizabeth II, is one of the world's oldest political associations of states. Its roots date back to the days of the British Empire. After the fall of the empire, 53 nations, including 18 African countries, which were formerly British territories, became the Commonwealth of Nations. How relevant is the organization today, especially in Africa? Trevor Grundy has been speaking to Africans and academics in London.
It doesn't have any power to resolve anything. It's just leaders come there, they just talk about it, nothing really happens. So it's lost its power.
As a Nigerian, I do not think Nigeria benefits from the Commonwealth. I may be wrong, but that's my view.
As a young person now at university, I mean, we don't really care about it as much. I think it's just more a historic thing rather than something to do with much more present issues.
It's completely irrelevant. It's just a waste of money. To me, that's what I think. And in a way, it's the Queen overruling the countries that she had power over.
Africans in London commenting on the role of the Commonwealth. So it seems that apart from the Commonwealth Games, which still remain relatively popular and which will be held in Glasgow, Scotland later this year, the intergovernmental organisation is in a crisis. At a recent conference held at Cambridge University, speaker after speaker described it as a wounded organisation in danger of sleepwalking into irrelevance. Philip Murphy, the well-informed and often outspoken director of the Institute of Commonwealth Studies here in London, says the so-called Club of Nations needs to do some pretty fast thinking and clever footwork over the next couple of years to avoid disintegrating, or worse still, from disappearing into oblivion.
There are major historical problems that the Commonwealth faces. I mean, it's been in crisis pretty much as long as anyone can remember. And one might well suggest that it simply had its day. that it was an experiment designed to really disguise the reality of the end of empire, which was given a little bit of life and vigour by the issue of South Africa and Rhodesia. But once that issue was resolved in the early 90s, it struggled to find a clear sense of purpose.
The end of all white rule in Africa ran like a silver thread throughout the Commonwealth from 1965, when Rhodesia declared its infamous Declaration of Independence, to 1990, when the late apartheid icon and former South African president Nelson Mandela was released from jail. That gave the Commonwealth a great cause. Is there another wave on the horizon to put a bit of bounce into worn-out legs?
No, I don't think there is. I think it's difficult to think of a problem for which the Commonwealth is the solution. Whatever it is now, whether it's poverty or debt or climate change, the Commonwealth isn't a logical block in which to do that. Maybe you can start to form a consensus within the Commonwealth, within Commonwealth discussions about important issues that you can then introduce in a wider forum like the United Nations. But the idea that the Commonwealth represents a logical grouping of nations in the 21st century is very difficult to argue. I mean, it clearly is essentially a legacy of the British Empire.
Murphy says that the Commonwealth's decline is like watching a car crash in slow motion. And just to prove that point, during last year's Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in Sri Lanka, Canada's Prime Minister refused to attend, and only 26 of the 53 heads of state bothered to show up. But in London, where the Secretariat is based, rent-free at a palace owned by the Queen, Commonwealth Club activists are often out in force. They regularly call for strong action against human rights abusers. Before Zimbabwe quit the Commonwealth in December 2003, the Commonwealth Secretariat had tried to put pressure on President Robert Mugabe to step down. He's still president, and though he remains blacklisted by most European countries, most of Zimbabwe's sanctions have been lifted. Secretariat remains quiet on this subject because Zimbabwe is no longer a member of the so-called club. Robert Mugabe turned 90 on February the 21st this year. He often says that his country will never rejoin the Commonwealth of Nations because, in his words, it's a stupid and irrelevant organisation. Sadly, many of its once strongest supporters are starting to say the same thing.
Trevor Grundy in London. Let's head down to Zambia now, where a court has acquitted top gay rights activist Paul Kasonkoma on charges of encouraging homosexuality. The ruling was hailed by supporters as a boost for African rights after Uganda passed a tough anti-gay law. Homosexuality is outlawed in Zambia, as in many other African countries. One group which played a key role in the acquittal was the Southern Africa Litigation Centre. Via Skype, I've been speaking to Annika Miyakota, project lawyer on social minorities at the Litigation Centre.
I think we're very encouraged by the judgment. In April last year, when Paul was arrested, he was arrested after he spoke on television about gay rights. He spoke about it within a context where he said that if we want to deal with the HIV epidemic, we do have to recognize the rights of sexual minority groups. And immediately after his arrest, you could see how activists within Zambia were scared to express their opinion about gay rights. And it's basically silenced discussion on an issue which is quite key for people within Zambia. So we were quite encouraged by the judgment. And I think the magistrate was quite clear when he said that public discussion is very important in a democracy. And even if it's about the issue which people don't like or might even be repulsed about, there's nothing wrong with expressing one's opinion, and that doesn't justify being arrested for it.
Paul is out now. He is a free man. But is he safe in Zambia now that his name is known all over the place?
I think it's always difficult for any human rights activist because they take quite the gamble speaking out about human rights, knowing that many people don't support their views. In Paul's case, he's been under considerable risk. Because it's a gay rights issue, it's been publicized in the media, and his picture has been on newspapers every time he appeared before the court, basically since April last year. So when he goes to a local market, people would confront him about his views and be quite angry with him about the views he took on television. He's been beaten up, so he doesn't feel safe, and he's got kids and a wife, and obviously for someone who's a family person, it's quite a worrying thing. But I think he's also extremely brave, and he knows that the only way to deal with homophobia is to speak out against it.
In your blog dated the 18th of October 2013, you mentioned that Carson Komer's trial was politically motivated. Can you expound more on that?
Paul was arrested immediately after there had been a number of homophobic statements by key people within government. And immediately after his arrest, the vice president had an interview with BBC or The Guardian, I think, in which he spoke about the fact that the government felt pressure to arrest Paul after he had spoken on television, and that they were basically pressured by religious groupings within Zambia. Religious institutions within Zambia are extremely strong, particularly those who are supported by American organizations, who bring a particular view of religion and homophobia into the country, very similar to what you see in Uganda. And I think that's the context in which the police felt that they needed to do something when Paul was speaking on television, when it clearly looked like he didn't feel apologetic about his views. And what's quite interesting and what came out of the court case was that the program on which Paul appeared, where he was going to speak about gay rights, was advertised in advance. So the police made a decision to arrest him before he even started speaking on television. They didn't even wait to hear what exactly his views are. We were very lucky in that we had an exceptional magistrate on the bench who from the beginning acted extremely professionally in how he attended to the matter and very objectively. And it was quite clear that from the evidence the state presented, they had no case against Paul.
As a law expert for minorities such as gays and lesbians in Southern Africa, what kind of difficulties do you encounter in your work?
I think for gay rights activists, a big hurdle before they even speak about the more difficult issues around decriminalizing same-sex conduct or same-sex marriages, before they can even speak about gay rights, they need to be acknowledged that they even have the right to speak. We're at the very starting basis, really, where we're fighting for the right to freedom of association and expression, and the right to be able to speak and express your views on issues in an open society. And that is quite difficult because many people think that there shouldn't be these discussions about gay rights. It offends them just thinking about it. And I think that's why in Uganda and Nigeria, you now have laws which are even more harsh against freedom of association and freedom of expression, because there's that fear that once you start speaking openly about issues, people will actually see that gay rights has merit and that people who are gay are no different from people who are heterosexual and should be treated in the same way.
Lawyer for social minorities at the Southern Africa Litigation Centre, Aneke Miyakota. And still on that controversial topic, make a date with Africa Link on Thursday when we'll be looking at the Western response to Uganda's anti-gay law.
Opinion.
For this week's opinion, let's return to the Zambian acquittal of Paul Carson Komer on charges of encouraging homosexuality. Homosexuality is a crime in 38 of 54 sub-Saharan countries. Many of these countries, which have outlawed homosexuality, argue that it is a European-imported sexual practice. Which brings us to this simple question. Do you think homosexuality existed in pre-colonial Africa? Send us your thoughts either by text message on +491609575910 and email to feedback.africa@dw.de or a letter to Africa Link, DW53110, Bonn, Germany.
News is everywhere. For the stories that really matter, tune in to Africa Link.
And now, as always, before we go, let's recap our main stories. South Africa has announced a 1 trillion budget ahead of the May 7th elections. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta has urged South Sudan leaders to respect the ceasefire deal. And a human rights lawyer has told this program that they were encouraged by the acquittal of a Zambian gay activist. If you'd like to take part in our Africa Link competition, you'll find full details on our website, dw.de/Africa. And there we come to the end of this edition of Africa Link. Hope you join me same time tomorrow. Until then, I'm Crispin Mwakideu. Bye for now.